This is the third in a series. The series is called Faith Challenge. And this is the topic, does faith make any difference for the self? I think it does. The question really is, does it make a difference which leads one to be drawn to faith, or does it make a difference which repels a person? Is it an argument for the faith, the difference it makes, or is it an argument against the faith? Again, today I want to use sort of the structure of question and response. So I want to begin with two arguments. They're kind of loosely linked, I think. The one I call, not with much originality, the moral argument against God, which is the argument from the reality of evil in its various forms. The second I think would be called the moral argument against faith. Whether there's a God or not, there is faith around, and look at what it does in the world. That would be the second topic. And then I want to try to respond. So I would like to talk about these two things first, and then try to work a bit more with the type of response. Tomorrow I will be talking about does faith make a difference in terms of its understanding of history? Has history bypassed the faith? Does the Christian faith have an understanding of history? Those of you who were here the first day, I sort of set up the self-world distinction as part of our modern way of thinking. And now I'm trying to discuss faith in relationship to those categories, self, world. Today, self, and tomorrow, world or history. Well, the moral argument against God has been on the surface of our discussion, or on the edge of our discussion, several times. I think that it comes in various forms. Perhaps the most pointed one is precisely the moral argument that the presence of such horrendous evil leads one to reject belief in God. If there is a God, this God is surely evil. There may be no God. I wanted to read a couple of passages that sort of catch up this issue for us. Robert Charlemagne is a Lutheran theologian who teaches at the University of Virginia. He has written several books. And he says, if you were to start out without Christian, or not strictly Christian, without faith, and just kind of inquire about God, where would you be apt to look? What events in the 20th century seem to require something more than an ordinary explanation, something extraordinary? And he said, well, certainly the Holocaust seems to require. Something's going on there. This is really powerful stuff. This is not just human beings that have done this. I'll read his quote. No single series of occurrences in the 20th century has so demanded a second language besides that of human agents, intentions, and actions, as has the Holocaust. What happened cannot be adequately told by a narrative whose subjects are merely human beings, political forces, and national entities. Something supranormal happened, but it is not clear what that second language can be. Some authors think that it calls for the negation of theological language. That is to say, it does call for saying something about God, but what it calls for is that God was not there and perhaps is not at all. Or certainly an alternative would be that God is there, but God is evil. I think that seems credible. If you think about it, it does seem strange, puzzling, that human beings could perpetrate so great an evil. Maybe you say, well, you're really naive. But this is a very clear-eyed attempt to annihilate a particular race, a particular group of people. It does seem to have a different scale to it, but it certainly doesn't count for God, it counts against God. I want to read a statement from Arthur Cohen, a Jewish author. He's best known perhaps for his fiction, Days of Isaac Simon Stern, and other writing. But this is from a book called The Tremendum. It's a little bit thick, but I think it's worth reading. The God of classical theism, that's what I sort of call the all Big Ten God. You know, the God with all the attributes, that super God, the God who's in control of everything and is pulling the switches. The God of classical theism, in no way constituted by, and Cohen uses his, so I will continue that, in no way constituted by his creatures or affected by the trials and alarms of creation, has disappeared finally into the folds of mystery, where reason cannot make meaningful the relativity implicit in God's involvement. The tremendum, the tremor, the tremendum of the Holocaust forces a resolution of this conflict, not alone as an obligation placed upon reason to account for its occurrence in a universe fashioned by a presumptively omnipotent, omniscient, and providential ruler, but even more as an obligation it places upon our humanity to account for the tremendum, to justify and to redeem, if that is possible, the surpassing suffering of its victims. Well, what Cohen goes on to talk about is the sense in which the flickering flame of faith goes out. If you look into the tremendum, he talks about the tremendum as a great abyss which sort of severs history. Before the tremendum, before the Holocaust, you maybe could still sort of, by whistling in the dark, believe in a good and omnipotent God, but this event severs history and it is no longer possible so to believe. I want to quickly add a second argument. They're not the same arguments, but it seems to me they're closely enough linked so that let me talk about the moral argument against faith and get that out in front of us. If you believe in God and associate yourself with the church, this argument goes, you are committing a sin against humanity. You are violating the mission of the human in our culture, in our world. I think no one has put this better than Eric Fromm, the distinguished psychologist who died a couple of years ago, in a number of his writings. One of them is known as The Escape from Freedom. Religion is the escape from freedom. Man for himself. I have a quotation from his Psychoanalysis and Religion, which I wanted to read. The basic theme here is that what religious faith represents is a form of self-alienation. You put the source of your value outside of yourself, and it is not in you, but it is in God. I have a rather lengthy quote, but it's so pointed that I think it's really worth reading. Talking about the way we alienate ourselves from ourselves and then the consequences of that. But this alienation from his own powers not only makes man feel slavishly dependent on God, it makes him bad, too. He becomes a man without faith in his fellow man, or in himself, without the experience of his own love or his own power of reason. As a result, the separation between the holy and the secular occurs. In his worldly activities, man acts without love. In that sector of his life, which is reserved to religion, he feels himself to be a sinner, which he actually is, since to live without love is to live in sin. And he tries to recover some of his lost humanity by being in touch with God. Simultaneously, he tries to win forgiveness by emphasizing his own helplessness and worthlessness. Thus, the attempt to obtain forgiveness results in the activation of the very attitude from which his sins stem. He is caught in a painful dilemma. The more he praises God, the emptier he becomes. The emptier he becomes, the more sinful he feels. The more sinful he feels, the more he praises God, and the less he is able to regain himself. Well, I don't think that's a real easy mark. Just as I am without one plea, but that, you know, nothing in my hands I bring. I can't do anything. You couldn't walk across the street, certainly. You couldn't do anything worthwhile. You're totally a sinner. You're worth nothing. All of the value is outside of yourself. Haven't you heard those sentences? I mean, doesn't that sound familiar? So this is a moral argument against faith. I like to link it with the earlier point about suffering. The two can be connected. And Dorothea Zola, in her book, which is in the bookstore, Suffering, has done this, I think, very effectively. She opens her book with a critique of what she calls Christian masochism and Christian sadism, which sort of lifts up the experience of suffering. And I have a quote from her, too. How do we interpret suffering? What does the Christian say about suffering? Well, she is critiquing a form of speech that she finds to exacerbate, to worsen the situation. I'd like to read this short quote. This is the way we tend to talk about suffering in the Christian religion. Suffering is there to break our pride, to demonstrate our powerlessness, to exploit our dependency. Affliction has the intention of bringing us back to a God who only becomes great when he makes us small. Suffering is understood to be a test sent by God that we are required to pass. It is considered a punishment that follows earlier sins, or as a refining which from which we are to come out purified. As I read that, I thought of another passage in Zola, which is very strong. She is really, I think, really going after a kind of exaltation of suffering here. If the believer finally sees himself obliged to speak of God's inscrutable decrees, he is admitting that all that is left to him as a last possible consolation and source of pleasure in his suffering is unconditional submission. Submission as a source of pleasure, that is Christian masochism. Bear your cross, and so on. Well, in other words, already the presence of suffering, but then the interpretation of suffering worsens the situation, makes us the more empty of any sense of power or value. I think I would like to take a brief pause here and see if you feel this is at all to the point. I want to try to begin to make some response, but we have already briefly stated a kind of moral argument against God and a moral argument against faith. Any reaction or question, comment at that point?
Did we answer the question of yesterday? Does faith make sense?
Yeah, what I hope to do is talk about experience of God and God who works with freedom. The two themes I had there, a limited and living God. A living God, and hence the subject of experience, and a limited God, one who works with freedom that is not. So I've kind of reintroduced them into this outline.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With regard to the Holocaust, I've thought about that a lot. Isn't it? God works through men, okay? A lot of men are cruel, mean. That's how the Holocaust happened. It wasn't God. I mean, we're given a free will here.
Yeah.
God is there, but he's not going to stop it. Man has his own free will.
I think that's about what I want to say, too. The question is whether it's helpful or sufficiently helpful to say it. What good is God then? You know, that question would come. Even if you don't say God has responsibility for giving that freedom to us, God should have known better. I mean, even if you don't say that, though some might say that, you still would say, well, all right, we're living in a rudderless universe. We're living in a universe where we're just on our own. And that, in a way, takes the problem away from God, but it doesn't help us in the sense that we can't. If you have a God who cannot prevent evil, is that God worth really worshiping?
Well, is that really the question, though? Isn't the question, what is the value of that free will that God gave us?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
There's a lovingness to that.
Yeah. Well, the other side of that is, we always say, you know,
working together, that sort of thing. Yeah, how is God working
is
with?
Called a Bonhoeffer, is he the one?
Yeah. Pretty hard to see much to justify that as a kind of means-end relationship. That God is using this. pretty hard to do that, I think.
Well, and the devil has a great role in the world, and I think he won that round.
We don't hear about the devil.
The devil, really, yeah. In the Bible, it says he's the ruler of the earth.
Well, maybe we should move into this second segment, sort of. And I think that there are, I've put the name Ricoeur here. There's a person who has written a very excellent book on the subject of evil. It's called The Symbolism of Evil by Paul Ricoeur. I don't know if that book is in our library here. I don't know. But he distinguishes three basic options. I'll write them here, but I don't know if you're going to read it. The tragic, the theogonic, and the Adamic. Although I think Eve would get some credit here, too. There are sort of three basic options, I think, for approaching this problem. Maybe there's a fourth, which just sort of throws up its hands and says, I can't think it through, I give up. But I don't know if that's really an option. Or another way to put it would be, you could compromise. I'll put down in this corner, it's not so important to get all these things down, but there are, you could compromise God's power, limit that, you could compromise God's goodness, you could deny that there's evil, or you could just say, it's all a puzzle, it's all a paradox, I can't think it through. I'm sort of assuming that you're here because you're not able to be satisfied with the last one. So that we really get rid of that. It doesn't mean that we won't at some point say that we hit something we can't grasp. But to start with that seems wrong. So you can compromise the power or the goodness or deny the reality of evil. I think that's impossible any longer. Virtually impossible. To sort of somehow say that it's an imaginary thing. We suppose there's evil, but everything is really good. Where would we wouldn't have had compassion for each other if there hadn't been suffering, or if there had to be suffering, it was a necessary good. It certainly is unevenly distributed, and some of it seems highly excessive. So I think that's really not available. What's left is to either compromise, limit the power of God, as you were suggesting, or to compromise the goodness of God. Now the tragic position really amounts to saying that God is not, first of all, to be thought of as good. God is God. God is the Holy One. It's up to God what God is, whether God is good or not. There's no reason to assume that God needs to be brought down to our standards of what is good. God is simply God. And if God chooses to do something, you are in no position to question God. And even evil, then, even the Holocaust must somehow be put under the causality of God. And this is a very popular answer. I don't know if it's popular with you. It's not popular with me. But it's widely present in the popular piety of our time. I remember teaching a class in Chicago, and this came up, and a woman came up afterwards and said her son had been killed in an automobile accident. And she was a black woman, and her son had been killed by a white man driving through the ghetto, and she saw a divine causality in this, because God was trying to get to that white man with a message to his conscience. And she said, it helps me so much to know that God caused that death, the death of my son. Well, you've heard that. I had a beautiful niece, 4-year-old niece, die. And my brother is a pastor, so in this case we had two sermons, one in the area where he's serving, and then one up in our hometown, Thief Falls, and Minnesota. And the first pastor got up and said, praise be to God that he has taken Mary, this child, home to be with him. Taken this child out of this evil. It was a case of spinal meningitis. Taken this child to be with him. This is a veil of tears. Then we drove 400 miles north, and 3 days later, and had a sermon, and the pastor said, the one thing we can say is God hasn't done this. God doesn't kill little children. I remember sitting with Terrence my brother, and especially his wife, Bev. And Bev said, how can this be? How can we have these absolutely contradictory? I mean, why didn't the church get its act together? I mean, here are two Christian Lutheran pastors saying absolutely contradictory things. Well, the first person was basically taking this magic view. I'm not able to take that. I think that the degree of evil, the magnitude of evil is such that if one says that God is really the causality working in this, one is finally accepting what I was calling yesterday an authoritarian relationship. One is simply knuckling under. I may not be able to prevail against such a God. I assume I can't, but at least I don't have to worship such a God. I can go under shaking my fist in the face of such a God. If God is the God who perpetrates the Holocaust or kills little children, the case of illness is more complicated than, in some ways more complicated than the other case of the Holocaust. But we have to try to start with the easier things, the forms of moral evil. So that leads me to talk about, there are two views that are possible here, the theogonic or the Adamic. The theogonic says that God is, they're somewhat similar actually, that God is in a chaotic struggle with all the forces of evil and even perhaps neutral forces, that God is not the one who made this world out of nothing, but that there is an eternal dualism and God is always struggling with that which is not God. One is not confident that God will prevail here, and yet one gives one's energy to that God, the moral character of God is certainly preserved in that view. It's not too much different from the Adamic. I think the traditional Christian view, which I would want to try to defend here, is the Adamic, which is the free will defense. That's why I want to talk about freedom as goal and means. Freedom is the means to God's purpose, and in some sense it's even a goal for God. God creates freedom, gives freedom to that which is God's creatures. I think it's worth rehearsing the argument, though I think you all have struggled with this, that if God is really to have a genuine relationship with that which is not God's own self, there has to be a gift of freedom. Now, certainly God could manipulate us. Certainly God could make us feel free. Maybe we try to manipulate our children and make them feel free, or they try to manipulate us. But God would have known that that was not genuine freedom. The relationship, there would have been no genuine risk for God, no genuine vulnerability, no genuine growth for God. So God had to make freedom. God had to let power out of God's hands if there was to be a genuine relationship. So freedom is a necessary means. Now, I guess I don't want to say that freedom is the absolute goal, because I think we are headed beyond freedom. Maybe even in a human relationship, there's some sense in which you get beyond freedom. Some of you have been married, let's say, for a long time. You're not free to do certain things that you would have perhaps been free to do 20, 30 years ago. It's not that you want to do them either, but you've grown, you've matured, you've developed. You've gone through freedom, but in a sense beyond freedom. There's a natural maturation. And I think the Christian doctrine of the afterlife is a doctrine which teaches us not just the return to freedom. The Christian faith is not a big circle from Eden to Eden to Eden, but we're getting beyond Eden to a situation where our freedom is matured and fulfilled. I want to talk more about that tomorrow under the Christian understanding of history. So freedom is certainly a necessary means. And it seems to me that it's possible to connect this with a doctrine of God as one who does seek a genuine relationship and does not coerce that freedom. There's some sense in which you have to be free to reject God, or else the freedom is simply a superficial and unreal reality. So this is the Adamic view, then, that finally the source of moral evil roots in the gift of freedom. Now, I think the reference to the devil, we should return to that.
Can I raise a question about
sure.
freedom? the free will defense. It seems to me that I have a real hard time understanding the value of that kind of freedom, how the value of the freedom to inflict suffering on other people outweighs the value of peace and loving and understanding and all the things that Jesus taught. You know, that it's more important for us to be able to hurt other people than it is to be like Jesus. And it seems to me it would be very, very simple. We can't wave our arms and fly, so we're not free to do that. If we all had skins made out of mylar or something, we wouldn't be free to shoot each other and stab each other. And it seems to me we would still have the freedom of intent. We could have the freedom to intend evil or to wish evil of others. And Jesus even says that if you do that, you're a sinner. So why couldn't we have the freedom to think we'd like to hurt someone, to hate someone, but then not be able to do it physically, you know, so that the things like a Holocaust couldn't happen, and yet Hitler and his crowd would still be free to have rejected God because they wanted that to happen, and they wish they could have done it if only, you know, they had the physical means.
I guess I have two comments. One would be just analytical, that I think where that would, the direction of that reflection, following down that road, that would really end you in the theogonic. That's not a criticism of it, it's an observation. That we're dealing with a situation where there are certain limitations on what God can do. God is working with material, and you can only make it certain ways. So you still have a doctrine of creation, but a much more limited creation. And there are people who following out your reasoning, would come out there, that this is the more plausible, the more credible thing. So now people fight for God. God has done what God could do. Now, I'd like to try to respond, though, from inside the Adamic view. It seems to me it would have to do with the doctrine of the person, the understanding of the person. If you believe, I'll draw a picture of the person up here. This is what the person looks like, a triangle. That is to say, it is a body and mind held together in will. It seems to me that as a unity, the person in willing has to be able to effectuate his or her will. We are not spirits, and an intention which cannot be effectuated, which cannot be brought into effect, it seems to me is weaker, just as an intention to love. I'd like to love you, but I have no body to love you with. This is a weaker love, it seems to me. So I think that if you're really going to talk about the significance of the person, in love or in sin, you need to involve the full person, body, mind, will, intention. This is a more radical gift of freedom. The other little piece in there that would come in would be the doctrine of, that we were talking about next door yesterday, would be the doctrine of the knowledge of God. I think the type of response I'm trying to give to you here would be to say that the principle of proportionality, the greater risk, the greater possible gain. I could give you an ineffectual freedom, but it could be less effectual for good as well. Your face doesn't look like I've convinced you.
No, not a bit.
You want to say something more?
No, I don't think so.
No, okay. Does anybody else want to comment on that? A will that could intend but not do, it seems a pretty weak freedom, I guess.
I'm curious to look at this from a slightly different angle. If one starts with the premise that man created God, how does that affect this whole discussion?
Well, it certainly changes it.
I realize what I'm saying is very non-Christian. I realize the Christian view of God creating humanity. I'm just wondering if it would explain any easier the different manifestations that we see of God this morning.
Well, I think the moral argument against faith, actually I cut that awfully short, and you could certainly argue that, see if this is down the track that you're going. That one thing that faith does is to create a God. Consider, for example, Albert Camus and his discussion of capital punishment. Camus' argument is that Ordinary people would never kill other people. It's only when you think you're acting for God that you feel you have a right to do this. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away, I'm acting for God. The power of the absolute. Watch out for religion. This is the moral argument against faith. That's one application I see. Now you look around at religion, it might lead you to think that humans have created the image of God, the notion of God. We had the devotion this morning. God created, I think she said, man, and man, being a gentleman, returned the compliment. But you'd cut off the first part there. I certainly think that's a conceivable view. When you look at the world of religion, it's certainly conceivable that this is a human fabrication. It's got plenty of humanity in it. Whether it's merely human is the question. As I was trying to say yesterday, it's at least human. Whether it's only human is the question.
Yeah. And yet there's no contradiction to that argument. If man is the source of evil, we don't posit man as being all good, not one of the big tenets. So there's no particular contradiction there.
Yeah, it certainly, the human person could still be the source of that. I think that's true.
A little bit. I think it's important to talk about other forms of evil. I don't know that I'm quite satisfied with concerning moral evil, but particularly natural evil.
About what I can say here is this, that it has to do again with the nature of the person, I think, that in order to be an effectual source of freedom, one needs to be able to have some sort of a network of causality. Things have to have reliable properties. There has to be a causal weave that can be counted on that works. If fire can cook your meat but not burn your skin, a world of instantaneous miracle where the properties were only present for good, but were preempted or co-opted, would be a world that would be unreliable. Would be a world in which my freedom again was not effectual. There was no test for my freedom. There was always an insurance policy. There was always a bailout position. There was no risk in my freedom. There was no genuine venture in my freedom. So I think what I want to talk about is a situation where nature is not an absolute mechanism, but there is a reliable set of properties which work. Now, I don't think we understand this fully. There certainly is chaos in nature as well. There is unpredictability, spontaneity. I have a book here entitled The Rational Theology and the Creativity of God by Keith Ward, and I wrote down the page I wanted to read to you as a suggestion of how to talk about this. Okay. It's a little bit thick again, but I hope it's worth reading. The universe exists in order to bring into being a creative, contingent, pre-realization of purpose in a communal and evolving personal form of being related to God as its source, ideal, and guiding power. The subpersonal basis of contingent creativity is a factor of randomness, which eliminates determinism, but at the same time eliminates absolute control. That is, in order to have genuine creativity, you have to have some subpersonal basis for that. And the subpersonal in nature basis for creativity is randomness. Where changes are partly random, there must be failures and imbalances, as well as fortuitous and productive interactions. That's the first point. The subpersonal basis of rational purpose is the predictable law-likeness of being, which eliminates anarchy, but also eliminates continuous providential adjustment of laws. Where changes are law-governed, there must be particular cases in which general laws are disadvantageous or destructive, as well as cases where they provide the basis for constructive planning. So that in order to have a sufficient rationality so that one can act with purpose, one needs a reliable structure. And then thirdly, the final point, the subpersonal basis for a developing community of being is a plurality of emergent forces which eliminates monotony, certainly not a monotonous universe, but also eliminates complete harmony. For many individual substances developed by interaction with each other, conflict and domination are as inevitable as cooperation. So one tries to understand the presence of natural evil by placing it within that structure, spontaneity, randomness, rational purpose, law-likeness, and then the interaction of a community of forces. Metaphysical evil, by metaphysical evil, I mean finitude. The fact that I can't explain this great truth to you.
Well, actually, that may be moral evil on my part, but the sense of limitation. Now, I think that's, again, built into freedom. To be free is to have a capacity within some sort of set of limitations. Terry talked yesterday, I think it was, about the sense in which limitation is part of the human. I think death is the ultimate limitation. And I certainly think that the scriptures teach us that we are born mortal. We die naturally. That doesn't mean that I can't kill you and you can't kill me. Not all death is in fact natural, but it's part of God's plan that life has its own span, and then death is the end. In the Genesis material, in the sweat of your brow you shall eat bread until you return to dust. Of dust you are made, to dust you shall return. Sin doesn't make you dust. We are intricate pieces of dust, and we'll return to dust. Sin exacerbates, the sting of death is sin. Sin exacerbates and certainly causes particular death. I don't mean that the Holocaust is a natural event, but death is natural. I didn't get to see the Kubler-Ross video, it's over there, but that's been one of her themes. I don't know if that was in what was presented yesterday. So this is an attempt to talk about, to try to respond to the moral argument against God, not the moral argument against faith, just the moral argument against God. From within the structure of a doctrine of creation, I was starting to respond to your point about evil and the devil, and I didn't get that, so I should do that. I guess I think that if we push that too far, what we do is we'd eliminate human responsibility, and we'd be in a devil made me do it sort of situation. And that would be moving from the Adamic into the theogonic, we would not be, it would really be denying human responsibility, human freedom. I think the notion of temptation makes sense. And I don't think it's mythological to talk about a more than human, a more than individual dimension to evil. There seems to be a connectedness. There seems to be a persistence to evil. There seems to be a reliability, which certainly makes the theogonic attractive. I wouldn't want to push that so hard, though, that it eliminates my response. I guess I think that another way to put this is to say that moral progress seems to be uphill. There seems to be an entropic tendency in the universe that pulls things down. Don't you find it harder? It's harder to write a clear sentence than to write an incoherent sentence. Well, maybe it isn't for you. It's harder to reach out to someone in compassion and love than to ignore that person. There is a downward tug in the universe. Now, I don't think that removes I can still do something, and I still have responsibility. But it's not just my individual acts of will, I think. Anything more? Now, I wanted to move on to talk about the knowledge of God and so on, and what happens to the self in faith. This was a kind of intermediate point, trying to respond to the moral argument against God from one of two positions. I think the tragic is unavailable, either the theogonic or the Adamic, and I'm still trying to do it chiefly within the Adamic. They agree in this, that right now, I think this is clear to you, they agree in this, that whether God created the world out of nothing or not, or out of matter, whether God was eternally forced to deal with that which is not God, or whether God created this, now God is working with that which is not God. Let me just put a sentence in here quickly. Self-limitation in origin yields real limitation in effect. Sometimes say God is self-limited, so that means God can just change it again. But now when God has created that which is not God, that's really there, and it really yields a real limitation. It is no longer the case that God can just snap God's fingers. I'm not sure that I can factor it out for you, but I think I can describe the factors a bit. I certainly want to assert that God is acting in the universe. Otherwise, we're done early. You know, I mean, there's just no point in this. It's no solution to say there's no God. I think that the way God acts is through secondary causes, so that I would think that one way to talk about this is the way that God, if I were to draw a picture of an event, it would look like this. This is going to be green now. That would be a picture of an event right there. And this is the center of the event. Here, freedom is operative. But all sorts of conditioning forces come in there, and God gathers and orders and works with those, and is at the heart of that event calling you, starting you. God gives you a will. God calls you ahead. Now, but that call is one that creates freedom, so it's possible to reject it. And then God works. My picture of God would be like this, around this X. God takes the effects of that event and cycles them back in and is back in the next moment, trying to work with. God can bring good out of evil, but God can bring more good out of good than out of evil. God is never totally at a loss, and I'm really nervous to say this, but even with the Holocaust, God is trying to work with the reality of the Holocaust. Of course it was a defeat for God. But what can it mean for us in terms of conscientious, you know, our concern for our Jewish sisters and brothers? You know, so I think that God is working both in forming and shaping the moment of the event, and in calling that moment, and then dealing with judging the consequences, feeling the consequences, using the consequences. I think it's a very active God, omnipresent, omniactive, but not omnipotent. Okay, am I making any sense? I've gotten this pretty much from Alfred North Whitehead, frankly. There's a beautiful book, Process and Reality. I could read you a paragraph if there was a popular demand.
You're standing, we're sitting.
This is really worth a quick minute. Process and Reality. Let me get the right page here. This is a description of the universe. Whitehead was a mathematician and physicist, and then a philosopher of religion. Okay, there are four creative phases in which the universe accomplishes its actuality. There is first the phase of conceptual origination, that's creation, God's creation. Deficient in actuality, God needs to work with us, it's deficient until we're there, God has to create us. Deficient in actuality, but infinite in its adjustment evaluation. God knows what God intends. Secondly, there is the temporal phase of physical origination, with its multitude of acts. This is the mess that we're in. These are all these particulars now. This is out of God's hand. This is all these little X's around the universe. Thirdly, there is the phase of perfected actuality, in which the many are one everlastingly, without the qualification of loss of either individual identity or completeness of unity. God takes all these. God is trying to knit all these, trying to make the many into one. God is trying to harmonize this throbbing universe and make it one. And quickly, in the fourth phase, the creative action completes itself, for the perfected actuality passes back into the temporal world and qualifies, that's the cycle, and qualifies this world so that each temporal actuality includes it as an immediate fact of relevant experience. The kingdom of heaven is with us today. The action of the fourth phase is the love of God for the world. What is done in the world is transformed into a reality in God, and the reality in God passes back into the world. The love in the world passes into the love in God and floods back again into the world. God is the great companion, the fellow sufferer who understands. Well, I know it's much too condensed, but that's the image. I certainly would want to have a very active God. Limited but active.
Come on, run
it. It's in the Messiah.
Well, you know, it's one of our hymns. Inaccessible.
Immortal
Is omnipotent in that list?
No, but help me dumb explanation.
Certainly, actually, maybe she has. If it's in Handel's Messiah, just our words from the Bible, if it's ever next to there.
Yeah.
There are passages like in Him We Live and Move and Have Our Be.
I think there's going to be a passage like with God, nothing is impossible.
Okay,
that'd be as close as coming here.
No.
It's from the Bible.
It must handle.
In fact, Carter was just quoted the other day.
This is mighty. What I would say is that you could even use it. I don't think you'd want to let me do this, but I could use a word like omnipotent if you let me say that it meant everywhere potent. Everywhere potent. Rather than saying that God has all potency, there's no other power. That doesn't make any sense. Who's talking to you now? God? No one's confused about that. You know? But that's the traditional doctrine. And it's very much alive in a lot of popular piety. If there's anything that's happened, God's done it. And I don't think that's a biblical teaching. Otherwise, what's going on? The whole drama of the relationship, the struggle of God. Why is God struggling with God's omnipotence? It doesn't make sense. Maybe you can find one verse somewhere that could seem to say that, but it certainly seems to go against the grain of it, which is a relational, covenantal, God working with that which is not God. God's struggling.
From the very beginning, He dialogued.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't think that's there. I want to say just a thing or two about these other two points. Yesterday I was arguing that we can have an experience of God, can have an experience of God. Everybody can have an experience of God. In a sense, I want to say that everybody does have an experience of God, but they may not know that it's that. So, now I want to talk first about the relationship between ambiguity and freedom. The sentence that I want you to memorize here is this sentence: ambiguity is the epistemological correlate to the ontological reality of freedom. Okay?
That was our bathroom.
Who stayed there?
It was printed up by the staff.
I've been arguing for the being of freedom, the ontology of freedom, that God wants there to be freedom, both as means and goal. What does that mean as far as the knowing process? The argument here is that what it means as far as the knowing process is that there has to be ambiguity. If everything is crystal clear, then the reason, this part of the human, is not caught up in that freedom. One is more free in an ambiguous situation than in a situation of total clarity. If I were to make my relationship to you a matter of highly specifiable, determinable, objectifiable, with no play in it, no ontological or epistemological play, we wouldn't be free. So ambiguity is God's gift to freedom, mm-hmm. on the reasoning, on the knowing level. So if you've got a God you can pin down and identify, you don't have a God who loves freedom and who gives freedom.
Is it also why popular religion is so, quote, popular? Because there's a definable, pin-downable God, and it's absolute, and it's very clear, and people can just cling to that.
And I think it entails the loss of freedom.
Yeah. But there are a lot of people who don't like the struggle with ambiguity.
Well, that's, of course, Dostoevsky, the Grand Inquisitor. Remember that? You think people wanted freedom, did you, God? Freedom is a very delicate gift. If you're going to be given freedom, you're going to be given ambiguity. At least I think that's the connection I wanted to see. Another way to put this.
If you're going
to
be given freedom, you also get responsibility. And it's a whole lot easier to not have freedom and have somebody say you get up at 7, and you go to this at 7:30, you go to that at 8, you go to that at 8:30 all through the day.
Then
that's easier. And to do it right, you say it.
I think, though, that we can still experience God. I mentioned one day, I don't know if you were here, this distinction between ambiguity and absurdity. I think we live in a highly ambiguous world, but not an absurd world. I was going to
Well, some of you may have read Peter Berger, and I'm thinking of the little book, The Rumor of Angels. This book I actually have out from the library here. What kind of experience would fit this ambiguity? It would be an experience, it seems to me, that would not cancel out the freedom of the self, but would sustain and nurture a sense of gift to that freedom and a sense of consequence for the freedom. I want to talk about, if you looked at the Goldenrod Cheat, you may remember these three words, a sense of giftedness, a sense of directedness, and a sense of momentousness. I think that human beings experience a sense of the giftedness of life. People walk out and say, what a great day. They say, well, all they mean is that it's a great day. The temperature's right and so on. I think, though, there is a kind of fundamental, elemental undercurrent, and people find a way to celebrate that. But that's a sense of the gift of freedom. On the other end is the sense of the momentousness of freedom. And I want to talk about the sense of the ethical, the sense of the moral, as a kind of point of contact with freedom. Fortunately, the sense of the moral does not depend upon a sense of God. God's grace is sufficiently abundant so that one can know the good and be called to the good without knowing God. But in knowing the good, there is a call from God. I think what we're talking about in religion is an intensification of that. I want to just mention the is-ought debate. How do you get from is to ought? What's wrong with a sadomasochistic relationship? They both like it. They're getting on splendidly. We say they ought not to live that way. How do we get from, I mean, there's nothing in the is that makes it clear they should not live that way, but we know they ought not. This is the kind of thing that Berger talks about. He mentions four or five what he calls signals of transcendence or rumors of angels. They are things like hope, humor, play, order, the child who awakens in the night crying, the parent comes to the crib and or the bed and pats the child and says, everything's going to be all right. Now, the parent doesn't know that everything's going to be all right. I mean, the parent doesn't know that, but to have children in our world is to have a sense of a signal of, I'm assuming that it's an intended child, is to have a sense of transcendence, that we're not in this universe alone, and that these children will not live out their days alone in this universe. Or the sense of play, the sense of humor. Humor and play depend upon the sense of the incommensurability of life, that life is not simply in our hands. The philosopher has these great thoughts, as Kierkegaard says, but can't get his pants on right. The sense of the absurdity of life, that life does not simply depend on what we do with it. The sense of the radical contingency of life. Or, again, the sense of justice. Berger talks about the Adolf Eichmann trial, and he says that, I think this is right, as I recall it, that there were totally non-believing, non-religious people who were saying things like, Adolf Eichmann's deeds cry out to heaven for justice. Of course, there is no heaven. Well, but there's a signal there. There's a call. There's a rumor out and about. I think there are experiences that are, maybe they're not experiences of God quite, but they're experiences that make contact. And it fits the situation of ambiguity. It's not strange. I think there's another point here that can be used, and that is the sense that that which is everywhere present is less discernible than that which is simply specifically present. I can tell green from red, but if God is 36 colors, it's pretty hard to spot God, because God is everywhere present. We observe by the method of difference, and that which is universally present, we don't tend to see. That fits the situation of ambiguity. We have an experience of God. It's not going to be a crystal clear. Now, what am I to say? Somebody says, oh, but as a matter of fact, I've seen the bumper sticker. I talked to God this morning and so on. I mean, my experience, somebody says to me, of God is crystal clear. That person says, I don't know what to do then. Maybe there are moments of intensification where a person can somehow focus in
and no a direct experience. It seems to me that most of us do not live on that level. Our knowledge of God is a mediated knowledge. It is a knowledge that works through other things, and that fits the way God has worked. I mean, even the as Kierkegaard says, even with Christ, there is dialectical ambiguity. It's quite possible to explain the person of Jesus by saying that, well, he's a particular Jewish person who fit within a particular consciousness. It's not obvious. God is never obvious. God is always resistible. God is resistible in freedom, and God is never obvious. There is ambiguity.